From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today on the program, we'll be talking about legislation expected to be signed into law this afternoon that would let college athletes profit off endorsement deals and the like. We'll also talk about the recent run of legislation targeting trans women athletes. That's all coming up later this hour. But first, we're going to be talking about allegations of abuse at an Illinois prison, specifically Western Illinois Correctional Center in Mount Sterling. It's roughly midway between Springfield and Quincy. Shannon Heffernan is a criminal justice reporter based at public radio station WBEZ in Chicago. She's been covering this case. Shannon, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you so much.
Listeners, as ever, you're invited to join our conversation by giving us a call. 800-222-9455 is the number. Shannon, let's start with Western Illinois Correctional Center. I mentioned where it's located. What else can you tell us about it?
Well, the way the prison is structured is it has four different housing units where people's cells are. But there's also an area of the prison that's segregation. That's where prisoners go when they're in trouble. And what kicked off this investigation is we got a tip that there was a blind spot there, a place without any cameras, and that guards were using that spot to allegedly beat people. And so that's what kicked off this investigation. It's a medium security prison and not particularly outstanding in any other way compared to other prisons across the state.
So you start your story with an attorney, David Kirstein, who's visiting a client there. The visit did not go as he expected, right?
That's right. He was going up there actually to talk to this client about his case. And when he got there, they told him that that there was no record that he was going to visit. This despite the fact that Christine said he arranged it ahead of time. And they told him that they would let him visit, but a guard would have to be observing the whole time. Christine agreed because he had driven 4 hours. And his client, who named Roger Latimer, who has autism, kept speaking very loudly and saying, you know, I was beaten in this blind spot. I went to the hospital. I had broken ribs. And he kept trying to get his client to be quiet because he was aware of the guard nearby, reroute him to talk about his case. But he couldn't do that. Eventually, Christian says, okay, I'll look into it. He goes to the guards and says, you know, is there a record of a complaint? Is there a record of a visit to the hospital? And they say there's no record of anything, which we would later find out not to be true.
Yeah, well, let's pause on that aspect of the story and skip ahead to another chapter. Can you tell us who was Larry Irvin? This is another person who is incarcerated at Western. What was his backstory?
Larry Irvin was a 65-year-old black man from Chicago. We were able to piece together some details of his life from talking to his family and looking at various court records. He lived with mental illness and had been in and out of prison and in and out of living at group homes. And he eventually winded up at Western Illinois Correctional Center because he had stolen a couple of watches from a hospital gift shop and tried to sell them on the street. When he tried to sell them to a woman, he slapped away her hand. He was charged with this and went to prison for a fairly short sentence. He was supposed to be there for about 3 years.
3 years. He did not survive to the end of that sentence, though, as we're about to hear. So what happened to Larry Irvin May 17th, 2018?
So Irvin was allegedly taken to the blind spot and was allegedly severely beaten by a group of guards. He wound up with multiple fractured ribs and a punctured colon, very serious injuries, which he would later die from just a few months short of his expected release.
And he's not, just to give maybe a, sort of an idea of the severity, he was not treated in the sort of prison infirmary or even at a local hospital. He was flown to a major trauma center in Springfield, right?
Correct. But that was after a delay. So they just put him back in a cell, looking at the records and piecing together the timeline. Then they took him to a local hospital and he was airlifted from there.
So let's talk about this blind spot. And this is sort of the crux of your story. You have this line in there in your reporting. You say video has become the main way victims of law enforcement brutality prove their case. And it's rare that an incident involving law enforcement gets attention without a recording. Prisons are covered with cameras. So, I mean, surely there was some image of Larry Irvin being taken. What was caught on camera? What was not caught on camera that day?
So there are a few pieces of that day that are caught on camera. You see what appears to be an argument start between Mr. Irvin and some guards, and then you see him dragged out of his housing wing. Guards say that he bit one of the staff members. You can't really see that on camera because of the way that the angle of the camera. He's taken. You see him on a sidewalk. He's bent over. He seems to be having trouble walking. And at one point, his pants fall down, and a guard pulls them off and throws them into the grass. And then you see him walk into this alleged blind spot. There is no camera footage of what happened there. But later, we do see a camera image of Mr. Irvin being taken away on a stretcher, supposedly to the hospital. And that's it. So you have this little bit of time where you don't see him. I think it's important to note that when we talk about police videos, often those videos are caught by citizens on their cell phones. You don't have that in prison. When you talk about prison video cameras, the prison is in charge of where those cameras get placed. The prison is in charge of how those cameras get used. The prison is in charge of who's able to view those cameras. So it's not like an open, transparent access to seeing what happens inside.
Yeah, they're not posted on Twitter or Instagram.
Exactly.
How did you end up getting the footage? There was a long fight there, right?
Yeah, we had a long legal fight. The Illinois Department of Corrections insists that camera footage from inside prisons is exempt from public records laws, so it can be very hard to get your hands on that footage, and we were only able to do so with the help of lawyers, and we worked on it for a long time to be able to get that.
So let's come back to, we began our conversation, as your story did, with a different person who was incarcerated at Western, not Larry Irvin, but Mr. Latimer.
Correct.
His story, he gets out, he hears about Larry Irvin's death, and he told you that a sort of light bulb went off. What was that connection for him?
Well, a light bulb went off because he's like, oh, I was beaten in that same location. I had very similar injuries. And it turns out, when we started looking into it, we also found that two guards who were connected to Irvin's death, one who is criminally charged, one who is not, was present that day, were allegedly involved in the day Latimer was beaten. We were able to get our hands on his hospital records. They show four fractured ribs. And the nurse wrote into her report that Latimer had been insisting that he wanted to make a police report because he was worried that he wasn't the only person this happened to and that it would happen again and someone would be severely injured. She also wrote that she was trying to take pictures of his injuries and guards stopped her. Guards said according to this nurse, if Latimer kept talking about making a police report, they were going to take him back to the prison and get the treatment there instead of at the hospital.
Yeah, I'd like to read a quote. You have a screen capture of, I think this is a hospital record, in one of the, I think this is a nurse writing that, you know, so this is secondhand, but the nurse recounting that one of the prison guards said, there will be no pictures taken. We have spoken to the major at the prison twice, and he says no pictures. If he, the patient, keeps talking about filing a report, we are to take him back to the prison, and he will be taken care of in the infirmary. I mean, it almost reads like a threat to sort of deprive this patient of care if he's insisting on reporting this as a crime.
Yes, that is what I interpret when I read that too. And I think it's important to say that Latimer is not the only person we heard this from. We were able to find a total of 9 cases, 8 people in addition to Latimer, who before Larry Irvin died, made accusations of being beaten in that blind spot by at least one of the guards we identified as being connected somehow to the alleged beating death of Larry Irvin. And many times you'll see these similar patterns where they're having trouble being able to make their case or get the information out into the world about what happened. In Latimer's case, one thing I think is telling is they opened an internal affairs investigation. That's an investigation that the prison does on itself. And that investigation was never finished. And the investigator later said he was just overwhelmed with other cases, so it was never completed.
Never completed. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce you. Listeners, if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Shannon Heffernan, who's a criminal justice reporter based at WBEZ, public radio station in Chicago. She's been writing about a case in the Illinois Department, a couple of cases involving the Illinois Department of Corrections, where several people incarcerated are alleged to have been taken to, there's a lot of cameras in prisons, but there was this apparent blind spot at Western Illinois Correctional Center. A number of prisoners have said that they were taken there to be beaten. One of them apparently died, or I shouldn't say he died, is alleged to have been beaten there. We're being careful because there's a criminal case pending, and it's, you know, people have pleaded not guilty. Let's talk about the prosecutions here. And let's start with Mr. Latimer, who's the person who has survived his alleged beating there. You also talked to the Brown County State's Attorney. This is the local prosecutor, not part of the Department of Corrections, but still relies on them to have to try and bring charges. And he ultimately decided not to bring charges in that case.
Yes, he ultimately decided not to bring charges. He did say he referred it to the feds eventually. And what he said is like, look, it's hard to get good camera footage out of the prison, and you often need that. He also said these cases are really hard to prosecute. I just want to note that, like, this is a small town that is very dependent on the prison economically. And if you assemble a jury there, a lot of the people are, as you're attempting to assemble the jury, a lot of people are going to have connections to the prison. The state's attorney himself, his wife worked at the prison. His brother worked at the prison at one point. His brother-in-law worked at the prison. I might have those family relationships wrong, but definitely his wife, three different family members, all worked at the facility. So you start to get a picture of how tied in the town is to the prison and how that might make it hard to bring local criminal charges.
When you think of a jury of their peers, the Brown County's population is just under 7,000 people. That was in 2010. I'm not sure we'll find out where it is after 2020. I mean, that's a pretty small pool for jury selection.
That's right. And it's mostly a fairly white population compared to the prison population.
And as the state's attorney said, who are you going to believe, the person incarcerated or the person, you know, you likely know through at least, you know, through town or through family connections, maybe, who works
right.
there.
And you have to remember his bar is he has to prove that something happened beyond a reasonable doubt. But he's dependent on the prison for all that information. And I think that's the thing we came up again and again and again. Any information coming out of the prison, almost any information coming out of the prison, is controlled by the prison itself. So it makes it very easy to keep things quiet. The blind spot is about much more than the absence of cameras.
So what did the Department of Corrections say to you about this incident? You mentioned you've been trying to get an interview with the director for a long time. That hasn't come through.
Yeah, we've been trying to get an interview with the director for a long time about this pattern of abuse and a wider pattern of issues in the Department of Corrections that has not been granted yet. We did get a written statement. They declined to comment too much because of pending legal matters, but they did say that they installed a bunch of new cameras at Western Illinois Correctional Center, including in that alleged blind spot. But we talked to advocates about that, like Jenny Volenkatz, who works for the John Howard Association and Independent Prison Watchdog Group. And she said, well, you know, that's not enough. You have to remember that who's viewing that footage? Who has access to that footage? The John Howard Association itself asked to have camera footage during COVID-19 because they were not able to do their regular monitoring activities, and so asked for a mix of footage from random days. And they say they were flatly denied that kind of access. So if you have cameras, but the public can't see them and the public can't access them, what are they doing?
All right, just a couple of minutes left in our conversation. Federal authorities ultimately launched an investigation into Larry Irvin's death, right? What is the status of that case?
So they charged three guards with civil rights violations. One has since pled guilty. Two other are going to trial. The trial is currently set for early August. So we'll see how that unfolds.
And finally, what ultimately happened to Larry Irvin after he died?
So Larry Irvin, when he died, was buried in an unmarked grave in Southern Illinois. His family went down to visit it, and I think they were very hurt because it felt to them like the state should at least find a way to pay for him to have a marker after all that they believe happened to him.
They had to find a map from the local cemetery, right, to find where his body was located?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. Does this suggest any, I mean, what are the broader implications of this story about what's happening in the Department of Corrections?
So, I'm so glad you asked that. I think it's really important that this not just be about a few staff members who were allegedly acting badly. I think what our investigation revealed is a system that works to make it very hard to get information and very hard for there to be solid investigations or accountability when there's violence against prisoners.
Shannon Heffernan is a criminal justice reporter at WBEZ in Chicago. Shannon, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us today on the 21st.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking about two components of college athletics in Illinois. One is the U.S. Supreme Court decision that had nationwide effect on college athletes. Then in about an hour, as we tape or as we go live on air in the 11 o'clock hour, in about an hour, Governor J.B. Pritzker is expected to be in Champaign at the State Farm Center, the big college basketball arena at the on the University of Illinois campus, to sign legislation aimed at allowing college athletes in Illinois to benefit from endorsements and sponsorships, their name, image, and likeness showing up on products. That is going to, we're going to talk about what that means for college sports in Illinois with one of the sponsors of that legislation, as well as an attorney who specializes in this sort of thing. That's all coming up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us.